The NCAA Final Four takes place this weekend, the two semifinal games tomorrow and the national championship on Monday. And we bring in the one and only Daniel Helm to talk about and break down these two games tomorrow and the national championship game on Monday. A pleasure as always to have you on the airwaves, my friend. How are you?
Gentlemen, always fun to be on with you guys. Hope you're doing well.
Well, and we certainly hope you are well also and enjoying the beginning of a festive holiday weekend. And I think it's fascinating to talk about this tournament because even if you aren't a hardcore fan, even if you're just kind of a casual fan, this thing has been a lot of fun to observe from so many different angles because you still have some of the heavy hitters in Villanova and Kansas involved. You got a big-name university in Michigan involved, and this thing has been loaded to the gills with upsets. What would you say is the most dangerous thing that you see on the floor anyways about the 11 seed in Loyola Chicago?
I think it's just how well they play together. You know, you see they've played together all season. They won 30 games. They were there for a reason. They come from a conference that has always put a good team in the tournament. Usually it's been Wichita State the last couple of years. So this isn't a fluke. Now, I know based on their seed and their school size it is, it's not the name of the other three teams. But those teams plays as well together as they possibly any team can. And the other thing that's very underrated about what they do is they play really, really good defense. They scout well. They take away what you do well. And they cause a lot of problems for the teams they face.
Dan, in your opinion, coming into this tournament, should Loyola have been a number 11 seed or should they have been a little higher? Did they get disrespected there?
Very much so, I think. You know, they come from the Missouri Valley this year, and Wichita State left to join another conference. And Wichita State has always been underseeded as well the last couple of years. They just went to the Final Four, I think, 3 or 4 years ago and as an 8 or a 9 seed, I believe. And, you know, when you win 30 games, you know, if a North Carolina or a Duke wins 30 games, they're guaranteed to be a number 1 seed. Loyola had a lot of big wins. 3 of their 5 losses this year were without that player Custer, who is the Conference Player of the Year. So you're looking at like 31-2 overall with that guy. They won at Florida in the fall. I mean, Florida was a 6th seed, but a pretty good SEC team. They've won the games they're supposed to. And to me, they've been disrespected just because of the name on their jersey.
Sure. And then I wanted to ask you, do you think this is good for college basketball, having the Loyolas, the Butlers in these Final Four tournaments? Or do you think we're going to come to an area where it's like college football, where unless you're in the Pac-12, SEC, ACC, Big Ten, you don't get in?
Oh, I think it's a great thing. Everybody's talking about it. You know, my mother, who's in her 60s, you know, talks about Sister Jean's on Good Morning America, and people kind of on the outer, not diehard fans are really following in and seeing what they do, see what Loyola can do, especially. I think if we had 4 teams that came from a conference like this, I think it would be a little overkill, and I think people would have a problem with it. But people want to see what Loyola can do against Michigan, what they can do if they get past Michigan. You know, can they win the national championship? Butler was a half-court shot away from doing it 7 years ago. Now, can Loyola kind of follow through with what they, you know, set the table for?
You mentioned Michigan. We'll get back to the Wolverines in just a second. But to stick with this theme here of the lower seeds and the upsets and the smaller conferences, those smaller schools, how much do you think this helps the case moving forward to get more of these teams in from some of these smaller conferences? The Missouri Valley Conference has certainly gained popularity for the reasons that you just mentioned. But do you think this might help out some of those other smaller conferences who are consistently fighting for more than one bid into the big dance every year?
You would hope so, but you know, you bring that up, and it's a great point, but even since George Mason probably 10, 12 years ago started this trend in the last 10 to 12 years, you know, VCU was the last team in the tournament. They went all the way to the Final Four. Butler played in 2 national championship games. So we've had these teams there in the past. Wichita State, Dayton has been to the Elite Eight. Xavier before they went to the bigger conference. But I don't think it's going to help their case because then you look at a Syracuse who goes 9-9 or 8-10 in the ACC, but all 20 of their conference games are on TV. I mean, how many times did we have a chance to see Loyola this year? You would have really had to have sought them out, and that's going to be the power conferences are always going to have the upper hand when it comes to those last few bids.
And that's interesting. You're right. I think some of that could be broken down regionally as well. You know, if you live in that area, maybe you're more privy to what Loyola Chicago has done, so maybe there's a bit more exposure there. But you're right, on a nationwide scale, it's awfully difficult to seek teams like this until you get to this time of the year. I just remember, you know, my days at Bowling Green, there were a couple of teams in there I really thought should have been in the big dance and did not make it, just because conferences like that, it is extraordinarily rare to see them get more than one bid, right, wrong, or indifferent. There were some really good teams, not just at Bowling Green, but I think, you know, in the MAC in general, there were some really good teams in the late 90s, early 2000s, but unless you won the tournament and you got hot at the end of the year, you were never getting in.
Yeah, and you know, great point, because there's been some good Miami teams, some good BG teams, obviously some Kent, you know, we had Kent State go to the Elite Eight. Akron has done well. I mean, you could name almost every, you know, the top half. Western Michigan, I think, went to the Sweet 16 back in that time. And one of the things that you bring up is you get hot at the right time, but those teams beat each other up because they're so similar. And a problem is when you're 12-6 in the MAC, it is a great thing. But losing six times to teams like Bowling Green and Central Michigan just doesn't have, you know, when Syracuse loses a game in conference, they're losing to Wake Forest or Clemson or North Carolina or Duke. So there's not a lot of landmines in that conference, and that's one of the other things. So a team in the MAC really has to do all their work in the non-conference. Then you do all that, then you're not playing a non-conference game anytime after December 1st, and people have kind of forgotten about you. And that's what Loyola was able to do. They had to win all but two conference games this year and win almost 30 games. And I bet if they had not won their conference tournament, they would not have made the big dance. And they've obviously proved they should be in it. And that's a problem. So if you're a team like the MAC or somebody like Cleveland State, you really, really, I mean, you almost have to go undefeated in your league to have that standout record until you can develop a relationship, you know, something like Butler did or Gonzaga has done out west.
We're talking NCAA College Hoops Final Four weekend with Dan Helm here on Bullseye on the Afternoon. Boy, I want to get to Michigan, and I want to get to the way Michigan was able to punch their ticket into the Final Four. This was a hot topic on Monday. You know, people were talking about why Florida State decided not to foul Michigan in the final 15 seconds of that Elite Eight game last week. Any thoughts on why they may not have decided to foul, especially since Michigan had a very difficult time with the charity stripe in that game?
Yeah, especially the way Michigan was shooting free throws. The coach had to come out and reissue a statement, you know, a day later. And when he was asked about it after the game, he completely lost track of what he was trying to say. And it was really just a bizarre whole, you know, set of circumstances. They must have just thought there was less time. And I think one guy, you know, if one guy pulls off, then, like, the other four are like, oh, we're not supposed to foul. And it seems like it was that kind of reaction. My other thought, too, with 15 seconds left, drive the ball to the basket and just get the layup, because they're not going to foul you. You're going to have an easy chance at a layup. That guy forced a three. You know, cut it to two. Keep fouling. Michigan had they wanted nothing to do with shooting free throws. So, I think it was just an overall – you know, that's a well-coached team and an experienced team. It was just a bizarre finish, and I think one guy may have pulled up. The rest of them just decided not to foul, or they thought there was less time because of the way that guy forced the three. But even the way the coach handled it after the game, it was really I'm at a loss for words at what they were doing.
What is it that makes Michigan so good? You know, we had a conversation with Sean Dunnigan of WBNS-TV in Columbus at the end of the Big Ten tournament, talking about just how hot they had gotten. Then they kind of sat back for a week because of the whole Big Ten tournament being a week early so they could carve out time to play the tournament at Madison Square Garden. That didn't really seem to affect them, clearly, because here they are still playing on Final Four weekend. What is it that's made them so good over the course of the past month?
Well, one of the things that really stands out about Michigan is they have, you know, four to five guys that can score anywhere between 10 and 20 points a night. You know, they don't rely on one guy. They don't rely on guards. They rely on guards and big guys. And another thing is they can adjust their playing style because of that versatility to really play at anybody's level. You know, last Thursday night in the Sweet 16 game, they scored almost 100 points. I mean, they were just on fire. They couldn't miss. They were running and gunning, and they looked really good. Now they get into a defensive slugfest on, 2 days later against Florida State. And, you know, they found a way to do it. Now they almost shot themselves in the foot with the free throw shooting. But they can play defense. They can get in a track meet if you want to get into it. They can shoot. They can put the ball inside. They finish in transition. So they really can beat you in many different ways. And they're, you know, not relying on one guy is huge. So if they've got a guy like Mo Wagner who gets cold and only can get you 6 points, they got three guys that can pick up the slack who can easily score 15 points. You know, and they would hit a buzzer beater against Houston because Houston couldn't make their free throws. And that was a guy, Price, who's only playing 8 or 9 minutes a game. So it just shows you how deep they go. John Beilein is very, very underrated. I mean, he played in the national championship 5 years ago. He was amazing at Richmond and at West Virginia, and he has really done a good job at Michigan.
Villanova, Kansas, Michigan, and Loyola. Dan, who's the best of those four teams left in this tournament?
I have to say Villanova. They are the best offensive team. They have the most experience. A lot of those guys have played, you know, 2 years ago, won a national championship. Kansas has a couple seniors, but Villanova really, you know, they're averaging almost 90 points a game. They lead the country in scoring. They're really going to be hard to stop. I think that the Cinderella story ends in the next game, and I think we're going to have a Michigan-Villanova final.
Any idea in your mind what Kansas can do in order to stop that offensive juggernaut in Villanova? I mean, you talked about all the offensive accolades for Villanova. They've had such an incredible year. Is there anything Kansas can do to slow them down?
Yeah, there sure is, and I think a lot of it is going to be how that game is called because Kansas is not very deep. You know, they're going to play about seven guys who can really contribute, and if they get in foul trouble, it's going to be a long night. They've got one big guy who can really play inside and do a good job, and they've got a bunch of great guards. We saw them that game against Duke. They're going to have to be a little hot. They're going to have to catch fire, and they have to play without fouling. And I know it's simple as that seems, but if you get a guy like Graham or if their starting center is, you know, sitting for 12 minutes in the first half, you know, Villanova could make that a 10 or 15 point game going into halftime, and they're going to have to play from behind. If they play good defense and the referees let them play, it's hard to tell on that big of a stage where guys get nervous, and that goes for the refs too, how they're going to call the game. And we could have two different games. You know, we have two sets of refs. That first game could be open flow, not a lot of fouls, where the next group comes in, calls a ton of fouls. But if they can play without fouling, keep their good players on the floor, they're going to keep it close because Kansas can score 85 points if they need to.
I want to touch on one other thing here before we close out with a baseball question. But, you know, when we first started having these discussions about 3 weeks ago, getting into the opening week and weekend of action, one of the first things you mentioned was, boy, you know, how great is it that a lot of the allegations and the discussions about those NCAA allegations have at least been tabled or silenced for the time being so that these kids could enjoy the spotlight and we could enjoy March Madness. The unfortunate side of that is that these things are going to pop up again. And we don't necessarily know the specifics just yet. There are a lot of rumors out there targeting who might be involved in these investigations. About how big of a window do you think we're looking at? Do you think these kids might get another week or so before these clouds start popping up again?
Yeah, I think so. I think we'll get through the game on Monday. You're going to start getting a lot of guys going into the draft. And then I think, you know, in about 2 weeks, we're really going to start hearing everything again. And I think a lot of that's going to – they'll probably try to get all that stuff released, like, you know, as big of a deal as the NFL draft is, you know, when there's a huge news cycle in sports and try to slip it in there, but it's not going to work that way. We're going to have some bombshells over the next 6 months as we get, you know, especially going into the summer. You know, April is a huge recruiting month. There's a signing period in there for, you know, for everybody that hasn't signed. You've seen guys getting released from, you know, scholarship papers that they've signed with programs that are, you know, mentioned in this. There's jobs that have opened up, and Louisville is just filled, but are they going to have sanctions for their new coach? And I mean, I think the dominoes are going to start falling. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see how much the FBI releases because they're really the ones holding all the cards right now.
All right, my friend. Well, we'll get off the hardwood for a moment, and we will take a trip onto the diamond. We've been talking about opening day memories, and everybody's got their favorite. You've been to many baseball games over all these years, both minor league, major league level. You've been a big part of opening up seasons at the minor league level. Do you have a favorite opening day memory, whether it be major league, little league, or minor league? Are there one or two that stand out to you?
I would say my favorite opening day of all time has been with the Lake Erie Crushers. It was 2011, and we had gone through some transitions in the off season, and it found me on top of the organization, and I was trying to get everything ready, and Ryan Gates had, you know, laid the foundation for a great thing. I actually had you as my radio guy, and I went down and did a thing on Fox 19 downtown, and Fox 8, I'm sorry, and that morning, and I was nervous, and the weather was perfect, and we had a full crowd, and I couldn't have been more proud of the effort and the things we put out there, and it's just really cool to see all that come together as, working 6 full months for one day. It almost sounds silly when you say it out loud, but we pulled it off and did a great job.
And on top of that, humble as you are, you left this part out. You threw out the first pitch for that home opener, and you delivered a strike. I think they clocked you at like 91, 92. Does that sound about right?
I think you're correct on throwing a strike. I think it was more like maybe 42 or so. We were organization of the year. We had the All-Star game that year. It was kind of a perfect storm, and everything was awesome about that. Obviously, you played a big part in that, and one of the most fun times of my life, not just professionally, but from a personal standpoint.
Yeah, that was a fun season. I remember that season like it was yesterday. Very, very cool stuff. Well, a pleasure as always to have you on, my friend. We always appreciate the insight. Safe travels this weekend. Enjoy the holiday. We'll do this again soon.
Same to you guys. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You do the same. Again, Daniel Helm joining us here, talking some NCAA college hoops and sharing some opening day memories as well.